You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 264, Exodus chapter 4, verses 1 through 17. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I'm ready and fresh to start a new chapter.
I know. It's crazy. Here we are mid-March, and you know, it seems like half the year. I can't believe how fast the year goes by. I mean, it's already March, and we're still just scratching the surface of Exodus. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know. All I can say is consider yourself, you were warned, you know.
Yeah. Hey, y'all voted for it, so you knew what you're getting into.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, what can you do? Yeah,
there's no
apologies.
No, I was just saying there's no apologies for it.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to look at it. Yeah, you know, we are indeed going into Exodus 4 today. We're going to do the first 17 verses. I'm going to leave the famous or infamous bridegroom of blood passage for next time. So let's just start by reading the 17 verses here that we'll get into, and we'll do what we usually do, just go through and, you know, make some comments on some things that are interesting. So then Moses answered, "But behold," again, he's still arguing with God, "behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" He said, "A staff." And he said, "Throw it on the ground." So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Put out your hand and catch it by the tail." So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Again the Lord said to him, "Put your hand inside your cloak." And he put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then God said, "Put your hand back inside your cloak." So he put his hand back inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. "If they will not believe you," God said, "or listen to the first sign, then they may believe the latter sign. If they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground." But Moses said to the Lord, "Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue." Then the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak." But he said, "Oh, my Lord, please send someone else." I love that line. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, "Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. And take in your hand this staff with which you shall do the signs." Now that is Exodus 4, 1 through 17. Again, there's some interesting things lurking around in here. This is actually Moses' third objection to God's call. The previous two were in Exodus 3 and verse 11. Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel? You know, I'm a nobody." And then Exodus 3:13, "If I come to the people of Israel and say, 'The God of your fathers has sent me,' and they ask me, 'What's his name? What shall I say to him?'" He's making excuses. And now God again delivers the divine name, which had, you know, something to do with presence. You know, God was promising to be with them. You know, "I have the power to do something new here." And we get into chapter 4, and here he is again. I mean, Moses has not broken stride. you know, "Behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice. They will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" Again, he's treading water here, and he's making excuses. And God responds by giving Moses three signs to perform to validate Yahweh is with him. You know, verses 2 through 5, we get the rod and the snakes. Verses 6 and 7, we get the skin-diseased arm and it's healing. And then, of course, following that, we get the water to blood. Asarna, here in his commentary, has something interesting to say that kind of gets us, you know, kicks us off here. He says, Moses is instructed how to dissipate popular skepticism should it materialize. Deuteronomy 13, 2 through 6 discusses the role of the sign in the legitimation of a prophet in Israel. Here, the signs, which will be executed in Egypt, possess a distinctly Egyptian coloration. This is not surprising, for magic was a pervasive ingredient of everyday life in Egypt, deeply embedded in the culture. The signs taught to Moses are intended, first and foremost, to validate his claim to be the divinely chosen instrument for the redemption of Israel. On a secondary level, they also function to establish the superiority of Moses over the Egyptian magicians, and by extension, to affirm the superior might of Israel's God over those whom the Egyptians worshipped as gods. Moses, however, is not a magician. He possesses no superhuman powers and no esoteric knowledge. He is unable to initiate or perform anything except by precise instructions from God. He pronounces no spells, he observes no rituals, and employs no occult techniques. And often he does not know in advance the consequences of the actions he is told to perform. That's the end of Sarna. And the last paragraph I think is really interesting because when you read the stories, it's true. Moses never does any ritual. He never utters an incantation, no abracadabra, you know, kind of stuff. He never casts a spell. Again, he has none of the techniques that Egyptian magicians and Egyptians generally would have expected. You know, he just says, look, I listened to my God. This is what my God said. Now let's just all watch. Because again, Sarna is correct. Again, as you read the story, there are a number of situations where Moses would not really quite have known what to expect, you know, what the fallout would be. And he sort of finds out with everybody else. And that would have spoken something, you know, to an Egyptian, because the Egyptians are expecting, you know, you're a magician, right? You do what magicians. No, actually, I'm not a magician. I'm just a servant of the Most High God. So you need to let us go. Again, there are differences there that are important. So let's talk about the first set, the serpents and the staff. The Lord says to him, what's in your hand? He said, a staff, throw it in the ground. He throws it on the ground, it becomes a serpent. And again, we know the rest of it. Moses gets scared, and God says, hey, take it by the tail, and it becomes a staff in his hand. Now, the English translation here, and if you compare the translation here to Exodus 7, 9, and 10, when Moses and Aaron actually do this, I mean, right now it's sort of God's just telling them what to do. But when you get into Exodus 7, they actually do this. The English translation sort of obscures an interesting item that some would call a problem. Okay, I'm going to read you the way the ESV has in Exodus 7, 9 through 10, just to kind of make the point that this isn't really very detectable in English. When Pharaoh says to you, prove yourselves by working a miracle, then you shall say to Aaron, take your staff and cast it down before Pharaoh that it may become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh, and he did just as the Lord commanded. Aaron cast down his staff before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. You say, well, what's the difference? I'm going to read you a selection from John Currid's book. That's C-U-R-R-I-D. Currid is trained as an Egyptologist at the University of Chicago. He teaches, I can't remember where, he teaches at one of the Reformed seminaries, I think in the Midwest. Don't quote me there, but it is one of the Reformed seminaries. But he has a book called Ancient Egypt and the Old Testament. It's a 1997 title. And he writes this. I'm going to give you some sections of pages 86 through 92. So Currid writes, when Aaron was ordered by Moses to throw down his staff before Pharaoh, okay, and he's commenting specifically on Exodus 7, 9 through 10 here in this section. When Aaron was ordered to do this, it was transformed into a tanin, is the Hebrew word, tanin. One would have expected it to change into a nachash, because the first sign given to Moses in Exodus 4, 2 to 3, that he was to perform in Egypt, was the turning of the staff into a nachash. Why is a different Hebrew term used in the two accounts? Let me just stop there. So back in Exodus 4, which is where we are, the Hebrew term for what the staff becomes, this snake, is nahash. But in Exodus 7, it's tanin, which elsewhere gets translated something like dragon. Okay. So Currid points this out, which you can't really see in English. And he says, well, why, what's the deal with the two different words? He continues now, many scholars argue that the alteration of terminology is due to the change in scene. They argue that tanin is a crocodile, because that word can mean dragon. They argue that tanin is a crocodile rather than a serpent, and thus more accurately reflects the Egyptian environment. Umberto Casuto, famous Jewish commentator, comments, quote, instead of the serpent most appropriate to the desert, in which form the sign was transmitted to Moses, comes here the dragon or crocodile most appropriate to the Egyptian milieu, unquote. Currid says, supporting that position is the fact that the biblical authors often use the word tanin of large reptiles that were more formidable than the simple nahash, and he cites a few passages. Other scholars argue that the variation in terms is just a matter of poetic license. Now, Currid, here's where he's at. He says, it is doubtful that the Exodus writer meant anything more than that the rods of Aaron and the magicians turned into large snakes. So he says it's not a crocodile, it's snakes. In the first place, tanin and nahash appear to be used interchangeably in the early chapters of Exodus. Thus, shortly after the serpent contest, God commands Moses, quote, go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. And you shall take in your hand the staff that was turned into a nahash, into a serpent. And I'll just stop there. In other words, the tanin word is not used there right at the Nile, which you would think if it's a crocodile, that's the word they would use. But he's referring back to the incident in chapter 7 where tanin was used. But here, later on in verse 15, Exodus 7:15, same chapter, a few verses later, what was in front of Pharaoh, what Pharaoh and his magicians are confronted with was not a tanin, it was a nahash. So the terms get interchanged. Back to Currid. He says, clearly the writer is referring here to the immediately preceding story where the term tanin is employed. The Septuagint is of little help in this matter, although it translates tanin into the Greek drakon, dragon, large reptile. It also applies drakon to numerous instances of nahash. Job 26:13, Isaiah 27:1, Amos 9:3. If anything, the Septuagint supports the idea of the two Hebrew words often being used synonymously. That's the end of Currid. Now, I just introduced that because I thought it was interesting, and you may, again, it's the kind of thing that you're going to find on a website, oh, contradictions in the Bible. Well, could we actually spend a little bit of time, looking to see if the terms are interchanged elsewhere and it really doesn't matter? Might be a good idea. So I wanted to introduce it here because of the novelty of it, so that you would know, people have noticed this and scholars have written about it, but the two terms in Exodus do just really appear to be interchangeable. And the mind of the translator, the Septuagint, the same thing is true. So we're probably just dealing with snakes here and not crocodiles. Verse 5, again, I want to draw your attention just to a word here. We have a repetition of what we saw in the previous week's episode in chapter 3 about God appearing, using that appeared language. We get it again in verse 5. Okay, God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has appeared to you. Again, same language that we talked about last time with the burning bush, and it's just reinforced here. Verse 6, then again the Lord said to him, put your hand inside your cloak. And then we get him taking his hand out. And the ESV has, his hand was leprous like snow. Now we covered this in our series on Leviticus. This term used in Hebrew is not actually leprosy. Okay, if you actually, you could go back to the episodes in Leviticus where we talked about this. The term used there and the description, more importantly, that is given in the book of Exodus is not consistent with what we know as leprosy today. So Sarna writes here, the Hebrew tzara'at, usually mistranslated leprosy, has none of the major symptoms of that malady. And the descriptions of tzara'at given in Leviticus 13 and 14 are incompatible with Hansen's disease, which is what we know today as leprosy. Sarna continues, the comparison to snow is not in respect of its whiteness, but of its flakiness. Apart from the startling phenomenon of the sudden appearance and the disappearance of the encrustation, this particular sign has an ominous aspect to it in that it is seen in the Bible as a divine punishment for human misbehavior. That's the end of the Sarna quote. So I just wanted to park on that a little bit and harken back again to our earlier episodes of Leviticus, just when it comes to that particular issue. Verses 8 and 9, if they will not believe you, God said, or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. If they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. And the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. So this sign, the Nile turning into blood, turns out to be used for the first plague, you know, as the actual story unfolds. It seems significant that at the continued resistance to, you know, the signs that Moses is giving, Moses runs out of signs. You know, he's got his staff there, you know, with the changing it into a serpent. He can stick his hand in his cloak. But if Pharaoh doesn't believe those two, he's kind of out of ammunition as far as objects or parts of himself that can demonstrate anything. So at this point, essentially, with the third sign here, the water turning into blood, God has to take over. And I think that might be the point. Pharaoh's resistance to a sign where clearly Moses isn't doing any, he's not manipulating an object. He's not doing sleight of hand magic. You know, the hand in the cloak, out of the cloak, back in again. Oh, look at that. You know, again, he's not doing any of that stuff after the second sign. The third sign is literally an act of God. And again, this isn't new to me. It's lots of commentators have pointed this out. It seems like Pharaoh's resistance sort of brings God forward center stage and says, okay, here we go. I'm going to turn the water of the Nile, which was like super significant because that's the lifeblood of Egypt, pun intended. I'm going to turn it to blood. It's going to pollute the land. This is an act of God. And so this actually launches the series of what will become known as the 10 plagues. It's a transition point. You know, Pharaoh's resistance to what Moses is doing turns out to be like the last straw. And then God says, okay, I'm going to take over from here. And the confrontation, when God enters the picture, as it were, you know, when it's an undeniable act of God, the confrontation therefore shifts to not Moses versus Pharaoh or Moses versus Pharaoh's magicians. Now it's God versus Pharaoh, who is the living Horus in Egyptian thinking. Pharaoh was considered the incarnation of a deity. In Egyptian theology, the Pharaoh was thought to be the living incarnation of Horus, the son of Ra. And, you know, as soon as the Pharaoh dies, his son, the next in line, becomes the new Horus. This was the thinking. The first name of Pharaoh's fivefold titulary. In Egypt, the Pharaoh had five names, and they represented different things, different aspects of either his rule or his nature or something. You know, the fivefold name, fivefold titulary. And the first of those was his Horus name. Now, Hofmeyer has a Bible review article on Son of God language in the Old Testament, how that compares, how that maps over to Egyptian thinking. And Hofmeyer teaches at Wheaton. He's an Egyptologist by training. He points out in his article, quote, during the Old Kingdom, which is 2700 to 2200 BC, the epithet, one of the epithets, you know, attributed to Pharaoh was the Necher Aa, the great god. This epithet was applied to the king, only to be replaced by the less exalted Necher Nefer, the good god, in subsequent periods. Additionally, the pharaoh could be called the image, Tut, it's T-W-T in Egyptian, the Tut, the image of a deity. For example, Tutankhamun, literally means the living image of Amun. That's the end of Hofmeyer. So the evidence is very clear that the Egyptians believed that the pharaoh was the incarnation of Horus, of a deity. And they would refer to the Pharaoh as the great god. You know, so when God says, okay, I'll take over from here, and starts pounding Pharaoh and pounding the nation, that speaks volumes. And again, Pharaoh's heart is going to harden. This is, he's not surrendering the title, okay, anytime soon. He knows what's at stake in terms of his own reputation. Pharaoh is supposed to be the regulator of the divine order. And the divine order says that the Nile floods at the same time every year and gives the land life, life-giving soil on either side of the Nile, the Black Land. That's what Egypt called itself, the Black Land, the Kemet, okay? The Black Land where things grow. This is miles, you know, of arable land out there in the middle of the desert. You know, the gods keep Egypt alive. This is why Egypt is great, because of the Nile. And God says, pardon me, I'm going to turn that to blood for a while. We'll see how that goes. So again, it's a shift in the confrontation and how it would have been read and parsed by Egyptians in light of their own theology. And we go down to verse 10, again, yet another objection of Moses, again, before you know the showdown actually happens. His fourth objection, Moses said to the Lord, oh, my Lord, I'm not eloquent. Either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, which I take as a generic reference to his servants. Or, again, you could say there's a little bit of space here between this conversation and the burning bush. Could be, but it could be generic as well. He said, I can't talk well. I'm slow of speech and of tongue. And it is true that you can look at those Hebrew terms there, and it could be that Moses was a stutterer. I mean, that's certainly possible. It's not terribly important, because even if he's not, he's making another excuse. I can't do it. Just can't do it. And of course, God says, well, who makes, you know, a man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Isn't it I? You know, get off your butt and go. I'll be with your mouth. I'll teach you what you should speak. But again, Moses isn't having any of it. So this is the fourth objection. And God has been patient, to say the least, up to this point. He has answered Moses' objections with, I'll give you signs, you do this, I'll step in, you know, with the water turned to blood, you know, once you get into Egypt, you know, I'll help you with what you say. I mean, I'm present. You're going back to our discussion of the name. And Moses just is resistant. So by the time you get to verse 14, you know, 13 and 14, God is angry. But he, Moses, said, oh, my Lord, please send someone else. Now he doesn't even bother making an excuse. He says, I don't want to go. It's pretty simple. Pretty simple. You know, you've handled my objections and my excuses. Let's just get down to it. I don't want to go. You know, I'm either scared or I got some other, you know, I don't want to go. Please send someone else. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. You know, and you know, he still doesn't just fry Moses on the spot, which you almost see like that would be the outcome. And he says, you know, look, is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. He doesn't have your problem. He doesn't stutter. Okay. Behold, he is coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. So God, again, has already anticipated this. God has already tapped Aaron on the shoulder, get out to the desert. You know, Moses is out there. You need to go see him. You shall speak to him, God says. You shall speak to Aaron and put the words in his mouth. You tell Aaron what to say. I'll tell you what to say. You tell Aaron what to say. You know, I'll be with you both. You know, like I am giving you the words, you're going to give him the words. You'll be to him like I am to you. That's why God says you will be, you know, as Elohim, you know, to him. You're going to play my role. The role I'm playing in relationship to you, you're going to play in relationship to Aaron. This is how we'll work it. He's on his way. Now, this is going to become significant later on when we get to, in the next episode, the Bridegroom of Blood, because Moses apparently just takes off. He doesn't even wait for Aaron. They never have the conversation, and God gets real angry. He's about to kill Moses. And that's not the only reason as well that God is really, really angry with him. We'll see that next time. But this is part of it. He doesn't even wait. I mean, he really doesn't want to go. It's pretty evident. Now, what I want to focus on here, though, for this episode is it is at this point that we have to go back and revisit something that we talked about in our earlier Hebrews series. This is when you get Aaron enter the picture. And once Aaron is in the picture, this is the beginning point of Aaron's role as intercessor for Moses to compensate for Moses' weakness. And, you know, honestly, I think there's a bit of a punishment in here as well. Aaron is going to be part of the picture now, and he's going to have an intercessory role in the place of Moses between, you know, for Pharaoh and also between the people in some instances, and specifically things like the Day of Atonement, you know, ritual, you know, where only the high priest was allowed to go in, you know, to the Holy of Holy. Moses didn't get to do that. You know, it's at this point where that starts. Aaron becomes part of the picture, and it is a concession to Moses' unbelief, his resistance. And we talked about this in our series in the book of Hebrews, because back then we spent a lot of time talking about Melchizedek. You shall be a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, this language about Jesus. And we asked the question back in our Hebrews episodes, well, what in the world is going on here? You know, I thought Israel had a high priesthood. It was Aaron. Why does the writer of Hebrews go back to Melchizedek, of course, who was the time of Abraham, predates Aaron? And we spent a lot of time talking about Melchizedek and his priesthood. And part of our discussion was the notion, again, in scholarship, again, this isn't unique to Mike. Mike's not making this up. You'll see this discussion in a number of places, where the whole presence, the whole peace in Israelite thinking and in Israel as a nation, in the worship of Israel, the whole element of the Aaronic priesthood arose out of this conversation. In other words, it was not God's original intention. It was a concession to Moses. It was God being kind. God could have very well said, okay, we're done here, fried, you know, or just go home. You're done. I'll go get somebody else. He doesn't do that. He gives Moses an out. Okay, there's a concession here. He's merciful. But this is where the Aaronic priesthood starts. It was not part of God's original plan. And we talked again about how that fits in with kingship and Melchizedek, who's the king of Salem, you know, Salem, Jerusalem, you know, how that became the model for the Messiah. You can go back to episode 167 and listen to that. I'm just going to, you know, sort of, you know, pick out a few summary statements here again from that material. But it's an issue for biblical theology. It helps to understand the Aaronic priesthood as being a concession. It helps to parse what's going on with Melchizedek and just generally what the template was supposed to be and why in the perfect servant, the one who doesn't make excuses, the Messiah, Jesus, why both of these things, the kingship, the leadership, the rulership, the political leadership of the nation is blended with the priestly relationship, why it's blended into one person. That was the typical pattern. That was the intended pattern. Because up until this point, and again, this is just a general comment, and I'll get into a few more specifics here. But up until this point, God is working through single individuals, not pairs. Okay, he's not doing Batman and Robin. There is no Robin. He's not working with his people as a group through pairs, through teams or duos. Their single leadership. This is the point of transition. And this is a departure from the heretofore normal template of doing things. So the original kingship of Jerusalem, think about it a little more broadly here, and I'll draw some material in from our earlier episode 167 when we were talking about Melchizedek. The original kingship of Jerusalem didn't go back to David. It goes back to Melchizedek. Again, Melchizedek was the model. He was the king of Salem. Jerusalem, get it? Okay, there's this connection here. He was the prototype. The original kingship of Jerusalem also entailed a priestly role. Melchizedek was also a priest of the Most High God. the priestly role would not be inherited by the sons of Aaron, like when it came to the Messiah. Okay, it would be inherited by the descendants of Abraham. It has chronological priority over the Aaronic priesthood. Again, the whole Melchizedek thing has chronological priority. So the Aaronic priesthood, when that comes into view, it splits the role. It gives Israel two leaders instead of one. The political leader was Moses. The priestly leader was Aaron. The argument that Aaron's priesthood, again, you know, was supposed to be like the original design just doesn't work. There's a good argument, again, and I think Exodus 4 makes it pretty clear. There's a good argument to be made that Aaron's priesthood was a concession to the lack of faith on Moses' part. It was plan B. And plan A would have been to have Moses be both the political leader and the priestly leader to intercede before the people, you know, for the people with respect to God. But that isn't how it emerges. The role splits because of this. Now you can say, well, Moses, you know, he still interceded for the people, you know, with God, and think about the wilderness wanderings and all. Yeah, he does that. He does that stuff. But when they get in the land, and the land is going to be the place where they build a temple, God's going to come and be their God. They will be his people. When they get into the land, that ain't the case. It's split in two. It's two separate offices instead of one. So it's at this point in Exodus 4 that Aaron's status is elevated to essentially co-leader. And that'll be his status. It'll lead to him becoming the high priest. Again, this is just how it works. Now think about what happens after this scene in the Exodus story. Moses apparently, again, if we look at Exodus 4, 24 through 27, he apparently leaves for Egypt without Aaron. Now, in this incident, the bridegroom of blood incident with Zipporah, where God is going to kill Moses, which we'll talk about next time, Moses apparently left for Egypt without Aaron. I mean, God had told him, look, you know, your brother Aaron's on the way. You know, you talk to him. Here's how it's going to be. Moses, he's out of Dodge. Well, again, that might indicate Moses is just a screw up. It probably indicates just plain old disobedience. He leaves Aaron behind after all of this wrangling with God and after God's anger and his compassionate concession. And just, you know, all of that right after he says, can you send somebody else? God's, you know, gets angry and says, look, here's what we'll do. We'll bring Aaron in the picture. After hearing that, Moses just takes off without him, without ever telling Aaron that he was part of God's plan. Now, again, we'll cover that scene, the bridegroom of blood scene, next time. But after you get past that, Aaron, I mean, think about what Aaron does. Aaron repeats the signs that God originally told Moses to perform. So not only can you well, Moses does priestly things, you know, he meets with God and he intercedes with God. Don't blot them out, God. You know, yeah, right. But Aaron actually also does Moses things as well. I mean, they're co-leaders now, when the original plan was to have one. So Aaron repeats signs that God originally told Moses to perform. An example is Exodus 4, 29 through 30. We read this. We're still in chapter 4 here, but we're past the bridegroom of blood thing. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses and did the signs. Aaron did the signs in the sight of the people. And of course, the outcome is positive. The elders believe, just like God said they would, you know, despite Moses' unbelief. Aaron acts in the place of Moses at other times. In Exodus 4 and 5 and 6, you know, you see this going on. In Exodus 6:12, for instance, Moses again does not believe the people will listen to him if he speaks God's words with them. I'll just read the verse. But Moses said to the Lord, behold, the people of Israel have not listened to me. How then shall Pharaoh listen to me? For I am of uncircumcised. He's complaining that, look, I can't talk. I told you, God, I can't talk. You're not going to listen. So Aaron is brought on the scene in verse 13 in Exodus 6 to get the job done. And he does. In the rest of Exodus 6, we get the, you know, you're reading along in Exodus 6, you know, Moses and Aaron and Pharaoh, and they're duking it out, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then right in the middle of that, you get what? You get a genealogy. Yeah, we'll hit this when we get to chapter 6, but we get the genealogy of Moses and Aaron. And then the text adds what feels like an explanation for why the genealogies are even there. Okay, here's verse 26 with the comment on the genealogy. So you got Moses and Aaron. Aaron's the co-leader. you know, he's doing what Moses won't do. And then you get a genealogy right in the middle of that, just thrown in there. And then you hit verse 26 right after the genealogy. This is what it says. These are the Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, bring out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt by their hosts. It was they who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing out the people of Israel from Egypt, this Moses and this Aaron. Notice the plural language. These are the Aaron and the Moses to whom the Lord said, to both of them, he spoke to both of them, bring out the people of Israel from the land. It was they who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing out the people of Israel from Egypt, this Moses and this Aaron. On the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, the Lord said to Moses, I am the Lord, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. But Moses said to the Lord, behold, I'm of uncircumcised lips. How will Pharaoh listen to me? Yeah, the writer actually brings verse 12 back at the end of the genealogy and explains why it's there. It's because on the day that the Lord spoke to Moses in Egypt and said, you tell Pharaoh, I'm the Lord. Moses said, look, I can't talk well. Again, an editorial hand here has actually put verse 12 right back here, right after the genealogy, to tell you why it's there, to tell you why there were co-leaders. And if you look at the situation, Moses saying, I can't talk. That is what prompted, you know, that's part of the transition to Aaron, to include Aaron way back at the burning bush in chapter 4. So the writer or the editor is telling you, this is why we got two. This is why we have two and not one. So basically saying, this is why, there you go. Aaron's here because Moses chickened out, or he was just a rebel. He just was disobedient. He was faithless. And again, you take that against the context of the wider flow of biblical history. The leadership, again, up to this point had been one individual, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. You could almost count Joseph, but we'll just stick with, you know, the major patriarchs here. So you got at least three. You can throw Joseph in there if you want. You know, then you hit Moses. They're single leaders, single mediators. There's no duo. There's no duet. There's no team. Okay, here with Moses, it splits. Aaron's priesthood is a result of Moses' unbelief from the very beginning. It's a concession. Incidentally, this makes the golden calf incident all the more tragic. You know, again, we'll get to that in the future too, because it's Aaron's fault. You know, Aaron screws up there. You know, Moses gets better, but by then, again, the Aaronic priesthood is in place. So, you know, this whole situation, this whole episode, these first, you know, 17 verses, and again, pick it up toward the end of chapter 4 as well, you know, and we'll save the bridegroom of blood for next week. It's kind of important. And again, I think it's important because of the role it will play, the role it does play, and the role it will play later, you know, like if you get into the New Testament with Melchizedek and all that stuff. It creates a context for why Jesus, again, refuses the two leadership roles back into one. Now, there are kings like David. Again, you can go back and listen to episode 167. David does some priestly things. There are hints of this. Again, and it's important that it's David. It's important that it's Solomon, because these are the archetypal figures, especially David. And it's his line. It's his dynastic line. This is the line from which, or through which, God will produce the ultimate son of David, the Messiah. And when we get that in the New Testament, the two things are brought back together. We get back to God's original ideal of one person who is both the political, military, you know, deliverer and the mediator between God and men. So this helps us understand why there was two in so many other contexts, why it goes to one, because it was originally one, and this is a concession. So I think that's important. The other thing I think, again, that we can get out of this is the tolerance of God. I mean, even though he gets so angry, you know, with Moses, and he's going to get angry with Moses on other occasions too, you know, he doesn't allow Moses' obstinacy to thwart what he wants Moses to do. Now, that's not the case with everybody. Sometimes God just does say goodbye, you know, so long, you know, that kind of thing. And he moves to another. He does that with the kings, you know, of Israel, the monarchy, the whole bit. You know, he doesn't do it here, which again, I think is significant, but it's really interesting. And we'll end with this. What's really interesting is when you actually read through the story, you get Aaron not only speaking for Moses, but actually doing things that Moses was supposed to do. And you get this weird, let's throw in a genealogy here so that our later readers know who we're talking about. It was these two guys. These two guys are who you think they are. It was the same Moses and Aaron that did, you know. And the reason why we had two is because Moses just quit. He chickened out. He wasn't going to, he didn't want to do it. And so God had to bring Aaron back into the picture. I think there are wider implications here as well for, you know, people who are sort of hung up on maybe priestly stuff as being, you know, somehow we need to connect, you know, priestly stuff to Jesus so that we do Jesus or worship Jesus right, or that we're disciples like Jesus. You know, we got to throw in this Levitical stuff. Actually, that wasn't the ideal. It really wasn't. So we should really check ourselves and not make it the ideal right now. Again, there's that's contrary to, again, the patterning here, you know, that goes from one to two back to one. It's contrary to that. And really, you know, ultimately it's just completely unnecessary. So again, I think chapter four has some good things to teach us, but we want to stop here and devote a full episode to the Bridegroom of Blood, because that's just kind of weird. It'll be fun.
All right, Mike. Yep. Looking forward to that one for sure. Could you give us a little teaser about that at all? Anything?
Yeah. I mean, it's fair to say that I have written up something on my website about this long ago. Let me just throw this in. The Bridegroom of Blood is really not a hill to die on. But when I wrote that thing up on my website, I don't know. It's got to be, boy, it's got to be pushing 6-7 years ago. Five, 6 years ago. We actually had somebody leave my church over it. I'm leaving the church because of what Heiser said about the Bridegroom of Blood. Like, really? Yep, really.
Oh, wow. Somebody left your church. That's crazy.
Yeah, I would think there are other hills to die on, but there you go.
All right. Well, hey, we're looking forward to that. We'll see how many people we can get to leave the podcast. Right. If you're going to leave the podcast over that episode, please email me and let me know.
Yeah, there you go.
So we can report back on that. All right, Mike. Well, we're looking forward to that next week. And we want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.